Dr. James Allman was professor at Creighton College for 18 years before he joined our faculty in the year 2000 as professor of Bible exposition. Since 1987, he has been a visiting lecturer in countries like Australia, the Ukraine, and numerous times in the country of India. He's conducted mission trips in those nations as well as in Siberia. He served as translator for many of the Psalms in the Holman Christian Standard Bible, written articles for various publishers, and his iTunes library includes volumes of classical music, which is one of his great passions. He's married to his wife, Jan. They have 3 children and 6 grandchildren. Would you join me in welcoming Dr. Jim Allman to our platform this morning?
It's gratifying to look out and see so many people here. The only thing I can attribute it to is that this is the first week of the semester. At this time of the week, it usually is pretty thin, so it's good to see you all here. 1965, I was in a junior in high school, and my teacher came to me. I was a musician. Thank you. And he came to me and he said, if you don't try out for the All-State Orchestra, I'm going to give you a B in orchestra this year. I'd never made a B in orchestra in my life. I thought, try out for All-State? That means tryouts. And that I don't do. I don't do tryouts ever. Ever. I didn't play solos. So how are you a musician? Well, that's a good question. So I went, got the music, and rehearsed, went to the tryout, went through the material, and lo and behold, made the orchestra. What an astonishing thing that was. I can't remember how many there were, 15th out of 15 violas. And, well, I made it. So I got my A in orchestra. I don't have to do this anymore. I'm done. So I went down to the university where they had the weekend for the All-State Orchestra. And they were welcoming us as they do. You are the best in the state, and we're so glad to have you here, and we want to welcome you to the campus. Now, chair tryouts will be held in, and I thought, chair tryouts? I don't do tryouts. If I'd had a car, I'd have been gone. Chair tryouts. So the first violins were here, and the second violins were there, and the violas were in the chemistry building. So we walked down to the chemistry building, and being 15th out of 15, I was the last to try out. And people were coming out of the little room where the professor was. They were saying, oh, that was just horrible. It was, oh, thank you, Lord. It was horrible. There's sight reading, and it's terrible. And I thought, oh, Lord, what am I going to do? Because one of the last times I played in public, I got into the music. I was playing by memory. My wife was accompanying me on the piano in Washington, D.C., at the church where Mark Deaver is pastor now. And I was playing along and suddenly realized that what I was playing had no relationship to what she was playing. The only thing I can guess is that I had skipped a whole line, and she didn't know where I was. She wisely finally quit. But when you but when you play a stringed instrument, things are you're in trouble when your nerves get hold of you. The bow started bouncing on the string. My vibrato got too wide, so the intonation went out. And it was a 3-story building. I went and hid on the 3rd story until well after church was over. She was hunting me and never did find me. So I'm sitting there thinking, 15th, there's sight reading and it's hard, and what am I going to do? So I waited and I prayed, Lord, you got me into this. You've got to get me out. So it came my turn. I went in and he put down a couple of pieces that we had worked on, and I played those. And he put another piece down. He didn't say that it was sight reading. I've been puzzled about this for years. Why didn't I tell him that I knew that piece? Well, he didn't say it was sight reading. Just put it down. And we had played that in another orchestra for 2 years. I knew the part by memory that he was so nervous. So I played it, and we went back to the original building, and they started announcing the chairs. Concertmaster for first violins, and second chair, and third, and so on. Second violins, when it came to violas, first chair, Jim Allman. And I heard people saying, he was 15th chair. Yeah, I was 15th chair. What happened on that? What was going on there? Well, a lot of things were going on there. But among the things that were going on there was that God was showing his greatness in my life in a way I didn't deserve. Does that make sense? I'd like us to turn to a passage that's become very important to me in the last few months, Psalm 34. Psalm 34 is a composite psalm. It starts as a thanksgiving psalm, a psalm of declarative praise. Then it turns into an instruction psalm, but you know, the commentaries always say this is a composite psalm, and they go through what I just went through. But as it turns out, declarative praise is never simply praise. It's always instruction to the people of God, because when you have experienced the saving work of God, it is the right and righteous response of the delivered one to tell the people of God, because the blessing of God never comes to us to terminate upon us. It always comes to us to flow out, strengthen, encourage, and enrich the people of God. So the whole point, in a very real sense, of declarative praise is to instruct people about who God is and what God does. The properly declarative praise portion of the psalm is down through verse 10. Let's read it. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul will make its boast in the Lord. The humble will hear it and rejoice. Do you see? It's not just for the praise of God. It's for the instruction of the people. Verse 3, oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name forever. I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and delivered me from all my, my text has fears, that's a valid translation, let me paraphrase it, terrors. They look to him and are radiant, and their faces will never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him, saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. Oh, fear the Lord, you his saints, for to those who fear him, there is no lack. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger. But they who seek the Lord shall not be in want of any good thing. That's what the scholars call the properly declarative praise section of the psalm. Let's look at it just a minute, a few things to say about it. There are several problems in this psalm, the first of which is the heading. I wonder whether we should take the heading seriously for the interpretation of the psalm. And then secondly, what does the heading imply? Well, the heading is probably original to the psalm. We have no body of hymnic literature in the ancient Near East, as far as I'm aware. Some may well have been discovered recently. But as far as I'm aware, there is no body of hymnic literature that doesn't have a heading to its parts, its pieces. So that in itself would suggest that this is probably original and should be taken seriously. Some of the psalm headings, I tell my classes, and you need to know this, in Old Testament scholarship, the point of view is that ancient people are stupid. I don't know whether you knew that or not. Ancient people are stupid, and they could do things that we can't do because we're logical. They were stupid, and they believed in miracles and things like that. But we know better. So, but it is that very thing. Psalm 30, for example, has as its heading for the dedication of the house. But what does Psalm 30 have to do with the dedication of any house? Well, either they are stupid who added that heading to the psalm, or they knew something about the psalm we didn't know. Are you with me? So maybe if ancient people aren't stupid, maybe I should take account of that heading. Bruce Waltke, who is formerly on our faculty, wrote an article in Journal of Biblical Literature in 1991 on the headings and made the case that they are original, and I follow his argument and accept it. Well, if that's the case, what are we to make of the heading? Well, look at the so-called heading. This is verse 1 in the inspired text. My favorite professor said, if what I'm reading is different from what is on your page, you must understand that I'm reading from the inspired text and you are reading a mere translation. So, so what's the heading? By David, a psalm of David when he feigned madness before Ahimelech, who drove him away and he departed. David feigned madness. This is a reference to 1 Samuel 21. Dr. Yarbrough's message yesterday is actually the precursor to this one. It is mine is the sequel to his. We're on the same track, looking at it from different points of view. In 1 Samuel 22, David goes to the cave of Adullam, trying to get away from Achish and also from Saul. But in 1 Samuel 21, verses 11 and following, David has gone to Achish trying to get away from King Saul. He thought, I'm going to surely die, so I've got to get out of town. I've got to get out into Philistine territory. But there, when the people recognized him and knew who he was, knew the significance of the man, they started warning the king Achish about him. And David thought maybe his life was in danger there. So what did he do? Well, our text says he feigned madness. And in 1 Samuel 21, he beat on the doors and he drooled on his beard. Now, that sounds like feigning madness, yes? So what are we to make of this? Are we to think of David as having gone there by faith and acting mad by faith? Many of the commentators actually say that. They say, well, this was the wisdom of David in responding. But as I read 1 Samuel, and I'm no scholar in Samuel, but as I read 1 Samuel, this event occurs right after David went to Nob, after he ran from King Saul the first time. You remember this? Yes, no. Move your heads in some direction. Let me know that you're alive. Okay, I see some nodding up there. It's either that you're having a stroke, or I don't know what it is. But he's gone to Nob to get bread. And then he goes to Achish to keep alive. Then he goes to Adullam. It's not until 1 Samuel 23 that we read that David inquired of the Lord. He gets some prophetic guidance in 1 Samuel 21. I'm sorry, 22, but he's not inquiring of the Lord as far as the text tells us. And each of the two events that precede chapter 23:1 create disaster for somebody. After chapter 23, and he starts inquiring of the Lord, there's a consistent beneficial effect of David's work in Judah and for the people of Israel. So my conclusion is David was wrong. So what are we to make of a psalm like Psalm 34 from a man who, if my interpretation is right, is actually wrong in his response to the whole situation? And the answer I have, and it's very important that we have this as a background for this psalm, is that even in sin, David learned to trust God and found out how good God is. How God even protects us in our sin. Even protects us when we're not confident that he will. In fact, when we're confident that he won't. God protects us. Let's look at the psalm just briefly here in this first nine verses or so. Just say a few things about it. Verses 1 to 3 are a declaration to praise. This is the normal beginning of a declaration, a declarative praise psalm or thanksgiving psalm. Every one of them begins in some fashion, I will bless the Lord. I will proclaim the praises of the Lord. I will praise the Lord forever. Some variation on that. And so here, David, as he writes this psalm, I will praise the Lord at all times. I will constantly speak his praises. I will boast only in the Lord. Let all who are helpless take heart. Helpless? But that's the point, isn't it? Who is this psalm for? And who should be reading this psalm? Who can receive the message of this psalm? Well, it begins, and there are several descriptions of the proper recipient of this psalm throughout it. First is helpless. Later in the psalm, David is going to say, this poor man cried out to the Lord, and he heard him. Poor? Well, yeah, probably as he's coming out of Philistia, he is poor. But shortly, he's going to have 400 men join him. And they're going to be raiding the enemies of Israel, the enemies of King Saul, the enemies of Judah, and bringing plunder back. And he's a Robin Hood of his day, dividing it among the people who are in need. But David may not well have been a financially poor man when he wrote the psalm. So what does he mean by poor? And the answer has to be helpless, this idea of helplessness. I have looked for resources everywhere I can, and there aren't any. Have you ever noticed that when you're looking for something, you always find it in the last place you look? That's just amazing to me. I don't know why you don't keep looking after that. Why do we always stop in the last place you look? Why don't you just start in the last place you look? Yes? But that's the point, isn't it? We try everything we can. And as I'm aging now in my years, you don't know this, but I actually got married when I was 2 and we started having children when I was 5. So my 41-year-old daughter then accounts for my 46-year-old body. But as I age, I find the Lord taking more and more props away from me. At the beginning of that process, it was painful. Still painful, but it's not painful like it used to be. It used to be, I gave it up grudgingly. Now, I give it up as an inevitability. Not yet embracing the removal of the prop, but giving it up as an inevitability. It had to happen. I have to come to love the Lord more than any other resource that I have. I have to learn that no resource that I have is sufficient except one, and that's the Lord. And that's David's point, isn't it, in verses 1 to 3? Verse 4 and 5, or indeed verses 4 to 7, rehearse the time of need and the time of deliverance. Normal declarative praise psalm. I prayed to the Lord and he answered me. Now, why does he tell people that? Well, it's wonderful. I'm so thankful for you, David. I'm so glad to know that he answered your prayer. What good is that to me? I sat where you sat, and I heard people talk about answers to prayer, and I heard people talk about victory over sin, and I heard people talk about coming to understand the grace of God. And I sat there thinking, God, you do this for these people. Why won't you do it for me? Part of the reason was I still had too many resources. I hadn't let go of things that I wanted to hold on to. They were too important to me. I had to have them. So why does David tell them, I cried out to the Lord and he answered me? Because part of the function of a declarative praise psalm is to instruct the people of God on what kind of God he is and what he does. Thus, if that poor man cried out, what poor man? Well, David. In what circumstance? When he had faithlessly run off to King Achish of Gath, when he had faithlessly tried to solve his problem of danger there in Philistia by acting mad, when he had faithlessly run off and hid in Adullam, and then actually went off to Moab to find safety. Is there no safety in the land of promise? And our answer has to be, well, of course there's safety in the land of promise. But we know the end of the story. David didn't. So why does David tell us this poor man cried out to the Lord and he answered? Because, some of you have been wondering when I was going to get around to this, what God has done in the past is a model and a promise of what he will do in the future, though he's too creative to do the same thing the same way twice, and as Dr. Kreider has taught me to think, but he's too creative not to do the same thing the same way twice. He won't do it in exactly the same fashion, but it will be the same kind of thing. And he does it over and over and over again. And if a man like David cried out to the Lord and he answered, do you and I have any hope? Is there any hope for us as we face the trials of life? Indeed, how shall we face the trials of life? What's the appropriate faith response to coming trial? It's here in the psalm. Let's read more. Verses 8, 9, and 10, the invitation to claim, join in trust. Taste and see. Isn't that one of those wonderful verses, but who in the world knows what it means? Taste and see that the Lord is good. Oh, the joys of those who take refuge in him. Taste and see. I looked at all the references to the verb taste this morning, all of them. I went through all of them, all 10, and looked at the meaning of the word. Most of the time it means something like take a taste. King Saul gives a decree that no one is to taste of food until the battle is complete with the Philistines. The idea there is you're not to eat, you're not to even so much as taste food. But then Barzillai, later in 2 Samuel, says to David, after David offers him a place at the king's table, Barzillai, who's an ancient man, said, you know, he could want to be one of the profs here at the seminary. He was ancient. So, but he said, what good would it be to go to your house? I can't even taste what I eat or what I drink. That is, I have no sense of taste in me. I have no ability to really enjoy food anymore. So what does it mean to taste and see that the Lord is good? Sample this. Get into circumstances that look like you're going to have to be destroyed. You're going to be destroyed either emotionally, psychologically. You're going to be destroyed spiritually. You're going to be destroyed physically. You're going to be destroyed economically. Get into circumstances. Try them out. See what kind of God God is. Find out the flavor, if you will, of the goodness of God. Verse 9, fear the Lord, you godly ones. And that fear the Lord seems out of place in such a context. And yet, in Deuteronomy 10, see, I know things that most people don't know. Because I have a doctorate from Dallas Seminary. And I know great and wise things most people don't know. And what I know is that chapter 10 of Deuteronomy occurs between chapters 6 and 11. And what's important about that is those chapters are the exposition of the Great Commandment. You all know the Great Commandment. The Great Commandment is, love the Lord your God. So why in chapter 10 do you have about 6 verses talking about fearing the Lord? Because fearing the Lord is what loving the Lord is. And fearing and loving the Lord is what taking refuge in the Lord is. And fearing and loving the Lord and taking refuge in the Lord is what trusting God is. So if hardship is coming, if a ministry looms which is too big, it's too much, if a problem is rising in your family that you cannot control, you couldn't anyway, you just didn't know it. My daughter, my oldest, drove off when she was 16 for the first time in the car. It was the most helpless day of my life. I up to then, I could protect her. I could do what I needed to make sure she was safe. But after that, as she's out on the highways and on the streets, I can't protect her anymore. And I just felt absolutely helpless. I didn't know it. I was helpless like that all along. I couldn't protect her any better with her in the house than I could protect her out on the streets. I just didn't know it. But if I learn to love the Lord with all my heart, soul, and strength, if I learn to fear the Lord, if I learn to take refuge in the Lord, I will find that there is joy in facing trial, even trials that come because of my folly. Yes or no? Even trials that come because of my sin? Yeah, I can take joy in them because I know a God who is good. Fear the Lord, you his godly people, for those who fear him will have all they need. Well, how come in 1978 we couldn't feed our baby? If we have all that we need. I couldn't feed my daughter. I didn't have money to feed her. I didn't have a refrigerator that would keep milk overnight. So how come I couldn't feed my daughter? If those who fear the Lord will have all that they need. Verse 10 goes on. Even strong lions sometimes go hungry. They're the ones who can best fend for themselves. But those who trust in the Lord will lack no good thing. There's an important quotation I want to read to you. It's from John Ruskin. I've given this quotation as from Thomas Jefferson for years, but that was because I have a faulty memory. And Ruskin says, "The entire object of true education is to make people not merely do the right things, but enjoy the right things." Not merely industrious, but to love industry. Not merely learned, but to love knowledge. Not merely pure, but to love purity. Not merely just, but to hunger and thirst for justice. The object of true education is not to make people merely do the right things, but to enjoy the right things. And this is the crucial point. You see, the people to whom this psalm is written are not people who are rolling in dough. They're not people for whom everything comes up roses. They're not people who wake up every morning singing praises because of the sheer glory of the morning. They're people who have learned to enjoy the right things and to welcome the right things. And not only welcome them, but to boast in the goodness of God in them. Verses 11 and following, the rest of the psalm, the instruction section, you have first instruction defining the fear of God in verses 11 to 14. "Come, my children, listen to me, and I will teach you to fear the Lord. Does anyone want to live a life that is long and prosperous? Then keep your tongue from speaking evil and your lips from telling lies. Turn away from evil and do good. Search for peace and work to maintain it." Well, why should we do those things? Because we're learning to enjoy the right things. We turn our mouth away from evil. Why? Because those who are people who love God with all their heart, soul, and strength, who fear the Lord, who take refuge in the Lord, are people who are marked by the goodness of God. How would we ever abandon the goodness of God for speaking evil? How would we ever abandon the goodness of God for telling lies? How would we ever abandon the goodness of God for doing evil? What would be our proper pursuit? It's to pursue peace and maintain it. Then the rest of the psalm, verses 15 to 22, are the advantages of those who trust. "The eyes of the Lord watch over those who do right. His ears are open to their cries for help, but the Lord turns his face against those who do evil. He will erase their memory from the earth. The Lord hears his people when they call to him. He rescues them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted. He rescues those whose spirits are crushed. The righteous person faces many troubles, but the Lord comes to the rescue each time, for the Lord protects the bones of the righteous. Not one of them is broken. Calamity will surely overtake the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be punished. But the Lord will redeem those who serve him. No one who takes refuge in him will be condemned. Now, this sounds for all the world like what people call eudaimonism. You do good to get good. So you do good, and God treats you well. You do bad, and God treats you badly. But look again at some factors in this passage, verse 15. This psalm is for people who cry out for help. Yes? Dr. Yarbrough defined, I think, this word yesterday as screaming. Do you scream when things are going well? No. You may yell when things are going well. You may shout when things are going well, but you don't scream. So, are these people doing good to get good? Or, look at verse 17. The Lord hears his people. They call to him for help. He rescues them from all their troubles. Or again, verse 18, the Lord is close to the brokenhearted. He rescues those whose spirits are crushed. Verse 19, the righteous person faces many troubles. Verse 22, the Lord will redeem those who serve him. No one who takes refuge in him. Why do you need to take refuge in him? In part, it's a political idea, Ruth 2, Judges chapter 9. It's a political idea of taking refuge under a king to protect and provide. But in part, it's the idea of taking refuge, for example, in a cave someplace. This verb, as far as I know, is never used that way, but the idea is there. You go to a high rock, a high place where you can protect yourself against the onslaught of the enemy and take refuge there. Then, folks, this is not for people who are rolling in dough. This is not for the healthy, wealthy, and wise. This is not for the successful. This is not for the powerful, for the honored. It's for the despised. It's for the outcast. It's for the hopeless. It's for the helpless. It's for the person who has tried every resource and found every resource lacking. You always find what you need in the last place you look. And we have looked at every resource and found that there is none but God. We're brokenhearted because everything we hoped in failed. We're crushed because our enemies are always too powerful for us. We're downcast. We're weak in spirit because we don't have the will to stand up. You don't need a stronger will. You need a stronger God whom you can trust when the events of life are overwhelming. Then, when you have that God whom you can trust when the events of life are overwhelming, you can come into them with joy because you know your God. With delight, with rejoicing because you know your God. Not because the hardships are going to be easy. They're not. They're going to be hard. Not because the hardships will just fade away. They won't. They'll get worse. Because God is in the business of making our lives impossible so that He is the only reason why we do anything we do. But when I have a God that I can trust, even such times I can face rejoicing in the Lord. I don't have to feign madness. I don't have to look back and wonder, did he tell me that was sight reading? I know that God is working his purpose. And as things get worse and worse and worse and more difficult, it's time for God to show up. Folks, I'm not preaching this passage because I know all that it means in my life. In fact, this morning I woke up thinking, I don't even want to preach this passage. I don't even want to. Lord, would you let me preach something else? And I've been working on this passage since early December. It's the only sermon I've ever preached that I've worked on that long. If you ask me 6, 8, 10 weeks ahead what I'm going to preach on, I have no idea. I'll tell you when I get up. But this one, the Lord laid on my soul. I could not get free of it. I'm telling you this not because I know what it means. I'm telling you this because I need its message. I'm not here yet. But this is where I need to get. It's where you need to get. That's where the people of God need to get. Because we have a God who is good. We have a God who is merciful, who redeems the life of those who fear him, who take refuge in him. Let's close with prayer. Father, when we see you, we're going to realize how absolutely silly we were through our whole lifetime not to trust you. When we see you, we will see the perfection of your being and the obvious evidence of your goodness demonstrated in the multitudes of people who will be around your throne. We'll see it and we'll begin to perceive how foolish we were, how silly we were, how ridiculous we are. And as I look at my little children, little grandchildren, and see them howling because we take the knife away from them and they know what's best for them, Father, I realize I am that little child howling before you because you remove the props and the resources that I've counted on to make my life meaningful. And I never have really come to trust you, to know you, and thus to rejoice in you because you are a person who causes joy in all who know you. So, Father, grant all of us that we may grow in our faith, grow in our confidence in you because you are worth it. You've never failed your people. Remind us, Father, that the great goal of your work in our lives is to teach us to enjoy the right things. And when we learn to enjoy the right things, we'll never lack anything good. For Jesus' sake we pray. Amen.